Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for October 12th, 2023. And first, a little bit of an apology. My web page has been under construction, and as always, it's a chore. It's a very difficult thing. I had a web page. My previous web page was about 17 gigabytes, if you can imagine that. A lot of material there. The new web page is still going to contain the radio shows, which is a big chunk of going back 23 years. Imagine, multiply that out, around 20 megabytes per show. And, you know, every week for 23 years, that's a lot of storage. But that's still going to be there. But some of the other content I'm taking down, and I'll be putting it in a different format, let's just put it that way. So hopefully the web page will be stable. I got kind of, erased a couple times by accident, or possibly more nefarious means, we don't really know. Anyway, go and visit my new web page. It's JM, it's the same web page name, jmcanniescience.com. And go there, or the short version, the short URL, which you can remember, is seven letters, JMCC, S is in Sam, CI.com, JMCCSCI.com. That's an abbreviation. And I got that at the very beginning of my career doing this radio show 23 years ago. Yeah, I shouldn't say career. Well, maybe it's a career, one of my careers. My other careers go back much farther. But, yeah, around 23 years ago, the year 2000, I started this radio show, the James McKenna Science Hour, at the Crossroads. And anyway, the time slot has been the same. Thursday evening, 6 p.m., WWCR, Nashville, Tennessee, Tower Number 2. And my webpage has gone through a number of iterations, and this one I really like. It's got three logos up there now. We have the JMCC Water Filters logo. We have the J. McKenna Science logo, which is beautiful. I want to show that off. Had it done professionally, all of these done professionally, and the JMCC wing logo are all up the top of the page, and then the information. It's not completely done yet. There's still some building to go on. The space related stuff is not filled out yet. Very little of that is there right now that would have carried over from the old page. But go check it out, jmccsci.com. And also, people have been writing in, where's your radio shows? I listen on the internet, you know, to the archives, and of course they have not been there. As of right now, I think there's two shows missing, the September, 26th maybe, and then the October 5th, a later date, more like the 27th of September show, or 26th, I don't know, something like that. And then the other show that's missing is the 5th of October, and then this show will be missing a little bit. But I've also encouraged people, get a shortwave radio. You know, we're living in troubled times, if you want to call it that. The world is just upside down, just absolutely bonkers. So I advise you to get a shortwave radio, learn how to use it, and listen to my show on shortwave. All the ways to listen are listed on my webpage, which is, once again, jmccsci.com. And there's a link up the top about the radio show, and then it's the archives. And then there's also how to listen. There's a subpage that tells you all the different ways to listen. And by the way, speaking of that, we are still on the summertime frequency, the 9.350, and we will soon be going to the wintertime frequency. But go to the webpage. I'm not going to try and repeat it here. And this show also simulcasts It simulcasts on 6.115 megahertz, and that's year-round, so that's the same frequency year-round. So I encourage you to get a shortwave radio and get prepared. I have a funny story I always tell, that I was getting a haircut one time. This elderly lady, she did a good job of cutting my hair, so I would always go to her, and so we got talking about this. And she said, you know, she started talking kind of concerned about preparedness and things like this. And I was talking about, yeah, I said, that's something, it's a topic I talk about, you know, on my radio show. And she goes, yes, I always have an extra can of tuna in the cupboard. I'm like, ma'am, I think we need to have a little talk about this. An extra can of tuna may get through you the evening. With you and your cat, but that's about it. So an extra can of tuna ain't gonna cut it in the modern world. So but there's a lot of scientific topics I want to cover tonight. I'm gonna talk about comets. I'm gonna talk about big flooding in China. I'm gonna be talking about quite a few different topics tonight. And maybe I should start out with this comet story, which is Comet 12P Pons Brooks is the official designation of this comet. But in July, it had an eruption, a very interesting eruption, where it's symmetrical and it has jets that are associated with it. That's the traditional astronomy term, is jets, because they think that stuff is shooting out of this comet nucleus. But really, these are electrical effects, and I describe this in my work. And now in July, I did a show on this comet dealing with this topic. And the same thing was happening back then, these symmetrical jets. And they're going, oh, that they're these volcanoes. Well, there's a lot of reasons to know that just as fairy tale science. A comet nucleus is tumbling. It's not just like static. So these jets are static. In other words, they sit there in the same direction, and it's very clearly electrical conditions. And this is what I call the horns of the bull in my work. I've talked about this before. And these are electrical discharges relative to the comet nucleus. But for example, the moon Io of Jupiter has this same effect, where you have twin plasma discharges coming off of the moon and then heading towards Jupiter. And the reason they do that is because of magnetic fields. The current splits. The positive charges go one way, the negative charges go the other way in this magnetic field. Okay, so back to comet P12 Pons Brooks. It's doing this again. Last July, it had a session of these symmetrical fixtures coming off the nucleus region, and it's doing it again. Now, like I say, the comet nucleus is typically tumbling, so if there were fixed locations on this nucleus that had jets coming out of them, as the traditional theoretical model would suggest, then they would be moving as the nucleus tumbled. Now, you might say, well, we've never been to this comet to know if it's tumbling or not. Well, you can look at these with a radio telescope and determine if the nucleus has a cycle or not. Very easy to do. So the very, very easy science, let's just put it that way. One could use one of the dozens of radio telescopes that are around the world to quickly look at this comet. It would take a couple, not even a minute, and determine if the nucleus were tumbling. And if that's the case, and typically it is, these nuclei don't just sit there. And then also you have to look at the direction of these offshooting structures, the offshooting in the terms of the like visible sense, that they look like they're attached to the nucleus there, or the nuclear region, because understand too that this comet nucleus is teeny, and would not be visible, even if you had a good telescope, you would need a very, very good telescope just to see the nucleus. It would be the size of a small asteroid, and that's what it literally is. So, but what is happening, these are electrical discharges, and it's an unusual feature, but there again, it's interesting. You'd have to look at where this comet is relative to the sun, relative to local magnetic fields, or, you know, there has been some solar flaring going on recently, and look at all the conditions. I haven't personally had time to do this. I wish I had more time to spend on comet science, but I'm busy with, say, the water filter business or other things, many, many, many things on my plate. My plate runneth over with things to do, just like just keeping everything floating here. But this comet in the news again, and it's been in the solar system, visible in the solar system for quite a period of time. So very interesting. I went through my show notes going back into July, and I could not identify the show that I talked about this comet. I think it was in the July time frame. But at any rate, yeah, that's why I don't have a personal secretary. Sorry about that. I don't have people to help me out with this kind of detail. So sorry about that. I can't identify the show that I talked about that, but hopefully you heard that show. Okay, some other interesting topics, current science issues. I'm going to describe how this works. And a ring eclipse. Now, this is a total solar eclipse. It's going to happen Saturday night in 2 days, the 14th of October. And this has been in the news media quite a bit. So, but what I'm going to do is describe how this works and also how the Maya and other ancient civilizations understood the cycles of lunar eclipses. And it's a counting process. It's a counting process. It's very interesting because there are cycles that overlap. And I'll talk about those various cycles of the moon and how you would be able to predict this kind of thing if you were a Mayan and did not understand really how the solar system works. And, you know, maybe the Maya did know how the solar system works, but just assuming they didn't. But they were all only using patterns and patterns of events. They would eventually get to lay these out on a timeline and go, you know, these eclipse patterns are repetitive. And of course, they did this over hundreds of years period. And so therefore, we're able to determine and predict when these would be. And that gave value, by the way, a tremendous amount of value to the astrologers. We'll call them astrologers because they studied the heavens. Astronomy has to do more with the measurement and location of things, whereas astrology deals more with what you would call the visible aspects of what's going on in the sky. And by the way, the whole, you think, oh, astrology, that's for, you know, next to Ann Landers in the newspaper and some, you know, crazy people or something like that. No, astrology was long before astronomy came along and made it into some kind of a science. Astrology existed predicting and understanding the motions of the stars and understanding the effects on humans. And this is the thing that I worked on with Russian scientists. This is back in the mid-1990s. I was working on a daily basis with Russian scientists from the University of Novosibirsk. It's hard to say. It's a tough word. But anyway, they were atmospheric scientists. And so they realized they had all kinds of things. There were tornadoes on the sun. They didn't know what caused them. There were electrical effects in the solar system. They had been to Tunguska. These are Russian scientists going to Tunguska and realized that there was nothing there. There was nothing physical like an asteroid or something that came in and hit at the Tunguska site. In fact, they found another one a number of miles away, just like that. But there again, there was, you know, like modern astronomers believe that, oh, maybe there was an airburst, which means that the thing blew up high up in the sky, and therefore there was nothing, there was no physical piece of something that came down and hit. And that's crazy. That's a crazy idea, because when stuff comes into the atmosphere, let's go to Winslow, Arizona, a little diversion here. You go to Winslow, Arizona, and there's a museum right there where the crater is, the famous Winslow, Arizona crater. And it's big. It's like a mile across or more. I don't know. It's big, a big crater. And the thing that hit is in the museum. It's a piece of metal about the size of my desk. And that's what hit and blew this whole mile-wide rock and solid rock and everything created this crater. It wasn't very big. So even when small stuff hits the ground, which it would, I mean, all of that material will say, oh, it vaporized. Well, it's still coming down at 20,000 miles an hour. A lot of momentum there. Even if it did blow up, there would be catastrophic cratering all over the place. Even there would probably be some metal chunks left over that would have created mini craters. There would be physical evidence, and there is none. It's just like this one point center where all the trees are just blown out all the way around in a radial direction and burned to a crisp. And, of course, up in the tundra, the Tunguska area is far north. So the trees, like spruce, basically spruce trees, are still laying there. And of course, they don't rot because there's not enough time for them to develop fungus, etc. So they're still there in the same pattern, but there's nothing, there's no cratering in the ground. There's nothing physical that came down. So these Russian scientists were very aware of this. And so when they got my work, they go, oh, yeah, this is, McCanny explains this because it's an electrical effect. It's an electrical discharge. There's a place called the Eye of the Sahara. It's in the northwestern part of the Sahara Desert. Same thing, electrical discharge. There's an electrical discharge on the moon Callisto of Jupiter. In fact, many places, many like Mercury has these too, where an electrical discharge came down, hit it, and created this ring structure. But there's no crater there. You would expect if it was something physical that there would be a crater right at the dead center, at the bullseye, so to speak, of this thing. And so anyway, the Russians were very interested in my work. But back to the concept of astrology, the psychologists at the University of Novosibirsk, having a hard time saying it tonight, the psychologists got wind that we were doing this daily exchange after class in the afternoon. All these scientists would get together and we would have these exchanges and talk about my theoretical work and translate it. And then these like lessons going back and forth. And I had a translator because I'm not, I'm bilingual, but not in Russian. So at any rate, this went on, and the psychologists at the university got wind of this. So they wanted to know more about this because they were studying the physical effects of the planets, because they knew there was something going on. In other words, astrology. They were studying astrology from a psychological point of view. And what they were doing, they were monitoring babies, unborn fetuses. They were monitoring them for signaling and reaction to different things. And what they realized is that the babies inside the womb of the mothers were reacting to the planetary positions, etc. And they didn't know what's going on. These are babies. Well, if you imagine a baby is in the womb, they don't have any of their five senses working because they're all shut off. They can hear. You know, they develop that at a certain point, the hearing, etc. But they really don't have all of their senses kicked in. And that's the thing. That's why the birth is very important and the point of birth in astrology, because that's the point at which the baby's other senses kick in. But the baby is very tuned to the position of the planets. And they were wondering why. And so my work described this because of the electrical discharges of the solar capacitor of all the planets. So when the planets would align, not a visual alignment, but a physical alignment, they would cause a great deal of excessive electrical discharge, and the babies would be sensing this. They were like little antennas in there, in the womb. And so they started studying this, and so they became part of this study, but this gave a physical scientific basis for the concept of astrology, that the position of the planets actually have something to do with the human psyche. Okay, so at any rate, these are empirical measurements. Astrology is an empirical science. In other words, it makes an observation. These are the conditions. These are the results. When you get down to physics, then you want to put a meter on something. What's the voltage? What's the magnetic field? What's the time-distance relationship and all of these other things? That's physics. Astronomy is more dealing with the position of things, accurately measuring, plotting stars, getting bigger telescopes for observation, etc. And then astrophysics deals with the physical side, the theoretical side of explaining what astronomy is viewing. That's kind of the structure. And then space science has to do with going out amongst the planets, typically, and understanding what's going on in our solar system and geology, etc., planetary geology, etc., etc. So, and then you throw in archaeoastronomy, which is another somewhat esoteric subject, very legitimate science, going back and studying the ancients and what they knew about astronomy and astrophysics and space science and astrophysics, everything. Okay, so now back to the Mayans. Okay, so we're wrapping back in this conversation back to the Mayan. And this, it's called annular ring eclipse on the 14th. And here's what's going on, basically, is the moon is in an elliptical orbit around Earth. So sometimes it's closer, sometimes it's farther away. And so that orbit, there's a couple factors to our lunar orbit, our moon that orbits our Earth. And so what's going on is that its orbit, let's take a flat table. So just imagine a great, great big flat table. Put the sun out in the center of it, and put Earth out there, and Earth goes around the sun basically in a circular orbit. It's a little bit off, it's a little bit elliptical, but for our purposes, we can say that the Earth goes around the sun on this table in a big circle around the sun. The moon goes around Earth in a somewhat elliptical orbit, so that means it's closer to Earth at some times and farther away. That's one cycle. This goes on like a 27 day cycle or orbital period. Okay, now there's a couple things about the moon. As it orbits Earth and Earth is going around the sun, the point at which the moon is closest to the Earth changes relative to the sun, our position as we move around the sun. Okay, so that's one factor. Another one is very interesting, is that, say, the moon orbit laid also in that same table, that big table. We got the sun over here, we got the Earth going around, and then the moon is going around Earth in an elliptical orbit, sometimes closer to Earth and sometimes a little bit farther away in its elliptical orbit. Say that orbit laid also on that same table. Then every month we would have a total solar eclipse. And a couple weeks later, we would have an eclipse of the moon. In other words, the Earth would block the light from the sun, eclipsing the light going to the moon, and the moon would go dark. It would happen. We'd have a solar eclipse, and we'd have a full lunar eclipse every month. But that doesn't happen because the moon's orbit is tilted. It's about 6 degrees out of that plane. Okay, so what happens? Only on rare occasions do we have a full moon, because that requires the alignment of the moon crossing this plane, this table that we have, at exactly the same time when the sun is aligned with the sun-earth alignment. Okay, so that doesn't happen very often. And you throw in this other factor that the moon is sometimes closer to Earth than it is at other times. Sometimes the full eclipse of the where the moon gets between the sun and us, if the moon is closer, you get to see a little bit of an edge, a ring of the sun, because it doesn't totally black out the sun. And if the moon is closer to Earth at that time, then the moon is bigger, so it blacks out more of the sun all the way out to, and that's where the original knowledge of the corona came from, because you could see all this activity out from the sun at the full total lunar eclipse. And of course, this goes back into history. So at any rate, okay, so let me just quick repeat this just to make it clear. If the moon is closer to Earth during the solar eclipse, where the moon is blocking out the light from the sun, then there's a ring around the moon where it doesn't totally block out all of the sunlight. And by the way, if you're observing this on Saturday, never look at the sun with your eyes. Never look at the sun with binoculars or any other optical equipment or using a mirror. Never, ever do that. Okay, so at any rate, do not look at the sun with your eyes. Okay, if the moon is a bit farther away when the total solar eclipse happens, the moon blocking out the sun's light, then the moon blocks out the entire disk of the sun, and you just see the outer part, the solar corona, which is kind of, it's still bright, but it's not as bright as the surface of the sun. Okay, now imagine that you're a Mayan. We know that just like this model, the sun is in the plane of the planets. The Earth goes around in this plane. The moon's orbit is offset. We understand all that. But what about the Mayan or other primitive people? And they were keeping track of this. They would keep, okay, this solar eclipse where the sun is black, where the moon is blocking out the solar light, you had a ring there. And then sometimes it would completely black out the sun. But if you kept track of this long enough, you would realize that there were patterns to this. And so these were patterns. Now, let me give you an example of another pattern. Let's do this. Let's take some disks. We'll take the same table. And every disk is going to have a mark, a little single mark on the outer edge of it. And we're going to roll these disks down the table. And one disk is 2 units in diameter, and another disk is 3 units in diameter. Okay, we're going to start these out with the little mark on the wheel down on the table, and we're going to start to roll these down the table side by side. Okay, well, the first turn of the wheel with 3-unit circumference, and the second wheel of 2-unit circumference, as we roll these down the table, those lines are going to match up again after 2 revolutions of the one with 3 circumference and 3 revolutions of the one with 2 circumference. In other words, 2 times 3 equals 6. And so we're going to have to roll the smaller one with 2 circumference 3 times, and we're going to have to roll the bigger wheel with 3 circumference only 2 times. And when you do that, they're going to line up. That's an example of cycles lining up. They're unrelated. One has a circumference of 3. The other one has a circumference of 2. And when you roll them, every 6 units on the table, they will line up. And then when you get out to 12, they'll line up again. And when you get out to 18, they'll line up again. So these are two unrelated things that are cycling to line up. And that's kind of like the same thing, although the situation with the moon is much more complicated. So what's going on with the moon is we have these variable factors where you have the orbital tilt. And so the moon only is in the plane of the planets for a very short period of time. And then it goes up in its orbit above the table. Then it comes down through the table again and down below the table and then back up. And so if the moon is coming up through the table, just as that happens to be the same line between Earth and the sun, you get a total solar eclipse. And if it's on the backside of Earth, you get what is called a lunar eclipse, where the Earth is blocking the sunlight from hitting the moon. And so, okay, if you started to keep track of these, just keep track, okay, and you have a calendar, you understand the lunar calendar is 27 days, it repeats, etc., you would be able to eventually get the patterns, no matter what your counting method would be, whether you're counting in days of physical days of the Earth rotating on its axis, no matter what your counting method or method of counting, you would eventually end up with these patterns, and you would be able to predict where the next one and the next one and the next one would be. And that's what gave these shamans or astrologers or scientists, whatever you would want to call them, they were in very high regard, and they kept their secrets. These guys kept their secrets because that gave them power. That made them important. And in a culture like the Maya, where you could have your head lopped off any given day for whatever reason, they also predicted when to plant, when to harvest. Because it's the old issue, like say you live in a climate where, like the Mayans, where you had the dry season and the wet season. If all of a sudden you're in the dry season, you have this storm blowing and you have a real rainy day, and you go, oh, okay, it's the planting season, let's go out and plant all our seeds that we saved from last year, and you go out and plant all the seeds, and it happened to be a random thunderstorm in the dry season. Now it's dry for the next 3 months and you lose all your seeds. Hey, that's the end of your civilization. So you have to know when to plant and based on the wet season arriving. Okay, so anyway, these guys had a lot of power. The same in Egypt. The same, remember when Joseph came into Egypt and he was sold by his brothers, basically. Because he was the favorite son. But anyway, he gained a lot of power because he knew certain things on how, related to the heavens, etc. And he was able to gain a lot of power and interpret dreams and things like that. So remember, he said, you'll have 7 years of abundance and then 7 years of famine. So you got to store up the grain for these 7 years of hard times, and he was correct. And for that, he was given a tremendous amount of power in that society. So these guys were top of the heap. They kept their secrets, like I said. If you look at other stories like the three wise men, another great example with Christmas coming up here, a few months away. But the three wise men knew the sign in the heaven when the Messiah was going to be born. And when they saw it, they started packing their bags, and it took them probably years to make this trip. But they knew that this was the Messiah, and they went and they followed the star, which was a comet, by the way. And every year I give my discussion why the Christmas star was a comet, and why the standard astronomy community, which is purely atheistic and communist, atheistic, etc., they try and tell you, oh, it was a planetary alignment or, some other stupid thing. No, the Christmas star was definitely a comet, but it wasn't just any comet, because we see comets all the time. Every day there's a dozen comets up in the sky if you know what to look for. So this was a comet that was unlike any other comet that they've been waiting for thousands of years. And as soon as those guys saw it, they knew. They started packing their bags and they went in search of it. They saw it in the east, but interestingly enough, they went west when they followed it. And that's indicative of a comet also. Herod's astrologers saw the comet too. So when the three wise men showed up in to Herod's realm, Herod was fully aware that the Messiah had been born. And he told the three wise men, he says, hey, you know, when you go find him, come back and tell me. And the three wise men did not, they didn't trust the guy. You know, it's like these are kings. These guys know about, what's going on in the world. And so that when they went back to their homelands, they did not go where Herod was. And of course, Herod had all of the firstborn killed because he wanted to kill that Messiah. That's how paranoid these people were of their power. This is how knowledgeable they were of astrology. And so anyway, and that's why the astronomers today poo-poo astrology. Oh, that's just, like next to Ann Landers in the newspaper. It's just funny stuff. No, astrology is very real. Let me tell you, the Russian scientists proved that. Anyway, that's a very good little discussion of this event that's going to happen Saturday evening, with the eclipse. And here's what you can do if you really want to see this. You take a piece of cardboard, just like a thin piece of cardboard, the kind that comes, say, in the backing of a ream of paper or something like that, just thin single layer cardboard, and poke a hole in it, with a pin. It's literally a pinhole. It's called a pinhole camera. And you hold it up perpendicular to the sunlight, and it'll cast a shadow on the ground what's going on with the sun. So that's a way so you don't have to look at the sun. And only, like I say, do not look at the sun with your eyes, with binoculars. Do not look with any kind of optical equipment at the sun. Okay, next topic, James Webb Telescope. This telescope is phenomenal. And it, by the way, is conclusively proved that the Big Bang is a bunch of hogwash. Because they're seeing galaxies that, here's the deal. You get going back to Hubble, Edwin Hubble, back at the beginning of the 19th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, early 1900s, the late 1800s, early 1900s, they were starting to get good telescopes, and they had spectrometers. They understood about spectroscopy, the analysis of materials using the spectrum of light. And so they started putting spectrometers on telescopes. And that's where they first were able to resolve galaxies, these systems of billion stars. And then were able to do a spectral analysis, and then he saw that they were redshifted. The light from these galaxies was all redshifted, so that led to the expansion of the universe concept and the Big Bang and the Hubble constant and all, and they, at the time it was okay science, because the only redshift they knew about was the redshift of the special relativity. And so it did make sense, but what they did not realize was that there was another source of redshift out there. And that's what I discovered, was the induced electric dipole redshift. And that's the cause of the redshift of all of these objects. But the James Webb Telescope, as they progressed and started building bigger and better telescopes, of course, then science progressed, but these theoretical structures remained. And so you get up to the Hubble telescope, which was, pretty darn good. It's out in outer space. There's no atmosphere to look through, no distortion. It's a really big telescope in terms of size of telescopes and, the pointing ability and the resolution, etc. Now, the resolution of a telescope is based on the diameter of the mirror. The bigger in diameter the mirror, the better the resolution. This is just simple optics. If you took an optics course, which I have done, you know, a serious optics course in physics, you would understand this principle. And no matter what kind of detector, no matter what kind of film you would use or whatever, you cannot exceed that resolution based on the diameter of the mirror. And so now comes the James Webb Telescope. It's so much bigger and so much better than the Hubble Telescope. And so what happened with the Hubble Telescope? Well, there were places in the sky that were just black. There was nothing there using previous telescopes. The Hubble Telescope comes along and they pointed at that region, and all of a sudden there's thousands of galaxies in that region, fully developed. So the same thing happened with the James Webb Telescope, where the James Webb Telescope looked at places that the Hubble could not see, and all of a sudden finds the universe just like we see it right around us, the same, fully developed galaxies. What they should have seen, according to the Big Bang, was a very young galaxies, just rarely beginning, very rudimentary stars with just the very lightest elements, not developing yet the very heavy elements. But what do they see? They see the universe just like we see it here, exactly the same. And of course, the astronomers are in complete denial. They can't admit it, that their hallowed Big Bang theory is wrong. So anyway, theoretical life in the Big Bang world just goes on. Oh, they'll have some guy come along and create bubble theory or string theory or some, you know, the theory of everything or whatever, some garbage science to, you know, so life can go on as normal in the ivory towers, where they get big bucks to sit there and pretend like they're smart. But at any rate, the James Webb Telescope now is able to see, get this, stars in other galaxies. It is so powerful, that has such good resolution, that it can literally see stars in other galaxies. I'm not talking about our own galaxy, which would be phenomenal beyond belief. And of course, we can see a lot of stars just with the naked eye in our own galaxy. But we're talking about stars in other galaxies. That is just absolutely incredible. So the unfortunate part is this is being managed and the data interpreted by scientists who are just stuck in the, you know, in the old world, let's just put it that way, and stuck in the mud and can't get out. The next topic, very interesting. Now, SpaceX rolled out a rocket this past week. I don't know if it went off or not. I haven't followed this particular one. It's called Psyche, as the launch is the Psyche project. And there's a spacecraft that's going to go out to an asteroid. It's called Psyche. And it's very high in metal content. So you know what Musk is up to. They've developed a project. And this is, look, this is just amazing, that they're already starting to go after asteroids with high metal content. And of course, if you could mine an asteroid with high metal content, it would change the economics of the world overnight. It would be like finding a small mountain made out of platinum on Earth someplace. Oh, my goodness, there I got all this platinum all of a sudden. It would literally change the economy of the world overnight. And I guess that's what you can do when you're the richest man in the world. But the thing I want to talk about here is the rocket itself and SpaceX. And now this is the Falcon Heavy, which is the biggest of the SpaceX rockets. But the point is that they bring them out horizontally, like the Russians. So they bring out the rocket empty, so it doesn't weigh much. It's just its physical structure. Then they have the hydraulic system, which lifts it up. Now, this is what the Russians did. When you see NASA bringing a rocket or the space shuttle, remember, they had the assembly building. So you got to assemble this thing and up in the air. And oh, my goodness, you got to lift all this stuff up in the air. With the horizontal rocket, everything is down at the ground level. And by the way, this is how my wing generators are designed, so the tower drops with hydraulics and lifts up. And it's a very doable thing. It's not engineering wise, it's not a big challenge. And of course, you need it properly engineered. But the towers for my wing generators have hydraulics where the tower drops. And you do all the assembly or maintenance or anything else down at ground level. You don't have to get up there on that tower, which is a huge, huge cost, expense, and difficult, and everything else. And if you have to replace something, you got to get that up there, and then all the people and have it. Oh no, it's a disaster. But that's what the three-blade wind turbines do, in their idiocy. those things are so bad. I mean, the fact that those even made it out the door is absurd, but I mean, absolutely absurd. Good grief. Anyway, back to the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket. They assemble them horizontally. So the rocket is horizontal, making it much easier, and then they roll it out to the launch pad horizontal, like the Russians do, and then they lift it up. This is an empty rocket, no fuel, and then they fuel it on site. And so, anyway, a very very interesting concept. But they're going out after this asteroid is called Psyche, and to mine it. That would be the next step, and then obviously bring some of that metal back to Earth. changing this is economy changing kind of thing where. If they were able to do that. But now there's a little bit of a side piece to this. They don't own the asteroid Psyche. It's an asteroid that's out in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, just like a regular asteroid and out in the asteroid belt. But it's high metal content. But so all of the research they're doing, all of the expense they're going to go out there and sample this thing, that's not the mining of it. So that means that somebody else like China or Japan or Europe or maybe, some James Bond type of character, you know, in these James Bond movies, there's like Dr. Evil or, you know, who could go out and mine it before Elon Musk could, or maybe go out and compete. You know, there's no reason to say that maybe I could go out there and mine that asteroid. Thanks, Elon. Thanks for the tip. I'll go out and mine it and get all the metal before you do. Who knows? Who knows? But at any rate, the real story here, though, is that SpaceX. And they have from the very beginning the model of rockets they're using, the rocket engines, the idea of using many small engines instead of one big one or a few big ones, like in the Apollo program. You're dealing with tremendous forces, tremendous amounts of, say, hydrogen flow, kerosene flow, depending on the fuel that they're using, and a very difficult. Very difficult to load these things up when they're vertical. But anyway, using the Russian techniques of using many, many rocket engines, not just a couple big ones. So Elon Musk has really done a great job of replicating and advancing what the Russians were doing. The Russians, by the way, we're launching every day. I have their launch schedules for going back into the 60s when we were waiting for the Gemini and the Apollo programs and the Saturn V, the Saturn I rockets even to launch and go into low Earth orbit and for them to maneuver, etc. While we were waiting months at a time for that, the Russians were launching sometimes 2 to 3 times a day with manned space program. They were up in space. They had, all kinds of time in space, starting to set records for the time in space, etc., understanding what it takes to be in space, developing the technology, And they would keep it very simple. There's some examples. For example, in Russian technology, and they're still using this today. If say they have a tank, they would use a lot of circular tanks with air, say oxygen, so that they would renew oxygen. They would have a valve. The guy would reach up and open the valve. Well, with NASA, you needed a automated valve, which cost a huge amount of money to develop, and then you needed redundancy. And the Russians just had a little valve. You'd reach up and open it up. We need a little more oxygen. Oh, there it is. And so the other thing, this is a kind of comical story I've told before, that the NASA put out a contract to develop a pen that would write in outer space. Because whether you know it or not, when you use a ballpoint pen or like an ink pen of any kind, it depends on gravity to pull that ink down in the pen so that it flows onto the paper. But in outer space, there's no gravity, so how do you write with an ink pen in outer space? Well, you need a special development, and you needed it. So NASA put out a special contract to develop a pen that would write in outer space. The Russians used a pencil. It works every time, no matter what angle you write at. It doesn't depend on gravity or anything. So the Russians just used a pencil. And that was, that's just an example of the kind of waste that happened in the U.S. space program. Just a basic example, and that happens all the time. So the Russians had to develop, in from the very beginning, they developed things that were that worked and would be long term. So they never changed their like rocket engine technology from the very beginning. They always launched with kerosene. They didn't use hydrogen. Remember when we went from the Saturn V booster, the main first stage booster of the Saturn V was kerosene. But when we went to the space shuttle, they developed hydrogen, which was a much higher thrust and a higher specific impulse, it's called, is the term. In other words, you get more oomph out of the weight of the fuel with hydrogen, but there's a lot of difficulties with it. And even with that, they needed solid state or solid boosters with the shuttle. So they could have built a rocket like the Russians did with a kerosene first stage. That's where the bulk of the fuel is. And of course, hydrogen is extremely difficult to work with. Say you have a launch day and you miss it. Okay, now what do you do with all this hydrogen? It's loaded into this rocket. And also, the other thing about kerosene is it's really not flammable. It's not flammable. It's like, if you put a match to kerosene, it's not explosive. So at any rate, all kinds of factors about kerosene, much simpler to use, it's inexpensive, it's available. So at any rate, the Russian space program was based on efficiency and long-term development. Once they got something working, they didn't change it. It was like, okay, we've got that done. We're going to put our engineering talent on something else. Yeah. So anyway, another topic here. I was going to talk about the flooding in China. Tremendous flooding in China across certain regions, in big regions where they had tremendous rain. So I'm not China's a big country, of course, but they have flat areas, plain areas where it, the water just has no place to go. As we know in this country, when it rains out on the plains, the water just piles up. There's no hill for it to run down or run away in an expedient manner. Just want to mention quickly the Jupiter winds. Now we're heading into this month towards the end of October, and brace yourself in a lot of places in the United States. In the next day or so, you're going to have some pretty significant winds. And these are straight line winds, are the Jupiter winds. They've already had them in the United States. And so it's It's something that's going to go on up until the end of the month. Last thing I want to talk about is the opening of some new cities, the Mayan cities around the Yucatan Peninsula. And Tikal is one of them, Chichen Itza. What's happened here is that, and this is, there's some new areas. I was there back in the 90s. I was at these sites when they were just beginning to work on them. They're near Chichen Itza, one, another one near Tikal, a couple of them near Chichen Itza, if you've been there. Big, big tourist area now. When I was there, I was able to park right in the pyramid area and camp out there. There was nobody there. There was nothing going on. This is back in 1971 to 2 in that time frame. But what's happened is it's called Lazar. It's a kind of a technique of measuring. It's a technique of measuring rock that's under the jungle. And they've discovered these cities with huge, enormous amounts of structure that there were basically cities where they believe millions of people lived. So anyway, I just want to mention that if you happen to be going to that area as a tourist, make sure you go to some of these new cities. You know, go to Chichen Itza if you've never been there before, but go to these new cities because, from what I understand, it's really amazing. They're huge, huge cities that dwarf Chichen Itza, which is a pretty big city. So they expect that maybe millions of people lived in these areas, if you can imagine that. Millions of people living in this area with all of the infrastructure for farming, for food production, for transportation, military, and all of the other... Oh, all of the other activities that went with it. Just want a quick mention that, of course, I don't have sponsors, I don't have grants, I don't have government programs, I don't do anything with the government for their ill-fated money. So I depend on you out there, and if you buy things from my websites, remember that you get amazingly good products, especially the water filter products, the MR5, whole house water filter, the best deal, which is the MR5, the UV sterilizer, and the extra set of filters, is $1,000 off still. It's that sale is going to go away very soon. It's on my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And go to the main webpage to see the brand new webpage, jmccsci.com. Have a brand new webpage. Go visit it. Check it out. And I'm out of time. So we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.